Welcome to Poking Holes in Blinders. Our special guest is Linda Ugalo. Here's a sneak peek into this week's episode.
This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to help people overcome their fear of speaking so they can delight in the limelight.
I felt that in the book. That is such a wide range of health and support.
If those conditions are present, then the performance, it manifests. We are capable of being at our best in those moments.
And now, on with the show. Welcome back to Poking Holes in Blinders. I'm Colin Fallenwetter, and with me as always is Dr. Brian Height. Today, we have a very special episode. We have a guest. Today's guest is an author, speaker, TV host, and speaking empowerment coach. She has been a performer for over 40 years with a master's degree in expressive therapies and movement studies. As a musician, dancer, and choreographer, she has performed in Morocco, India, Bulgaria, and countless cities across the United States. She is joining us today to discuss her book, Delight in the Limelight, Overcoming Your Fear of Being Seen, and Realize Your Dreams, and whatever else comes up. Please help me welcome our special guest, Linda Ugalo. Yay, Linda!
Yeah. Thanks for coming, Linda. We really appreciate having you.
Oh, it's so great to be here, Brian. Thanks, Colin, for that.
You're welcome. Just to start right off, we'd love to just hear a little bit about you and your path and your passion and how you got started into helping people out in public speaking.
This was definitely not anything I ever considered doing for my life's work. It came as a total surprise. I started out, as you mentioned, in expressive arts therapy and movement, and I was very much involved with using dance and movement as a personal growth tool. And at some point, I became very disillusioned because I wasn't able to create a business out of it. And I found myself really struck by this feeling of professional jealousy, I'd call it. I felt very jealous of other people who were doing similar things as me. And I felt like I didn't have any control over my feelings. And it felt like horrible. And I decided that I'd rather not do it than endure these negative feelings in myself. And so I quit. And at that point, I thought, well, then what do I do with my life? I had no idea where I was going to go with it. But soon after, I got married. I had a child. We homeschooled. So that kind of took my attention. And always at the side, as you mentioned, I was a performer. So I had this gig going on, ongoing gig that saw me through my whole adult life of performing. It was a women's world music group. After homeschooling ended, my daughter went to school. I picked up organic farming, of all things. I always loved growing things, and I became involved with the organic farming community. I thought, wouldn't it be cool to be an organic farmer? And I loved their values. I loved the things they talked about. I loved everything about what they did. And I created a business selling specialty vegetables to local restaurants. And then during that time, I became aware of the whole online space. And I joined an online business school by Marie Forleo. It was called B School. And I was listening to it, and I altered my farm business according to her ideas about marketing and building raving fans and all this. I'm sure I was the only farmer in the group. And it worked out well. I walk into restaurants and they go, great, Linda's here. We love your stuff. And it was very fulfilling in that way. And then the following year came around, and I remember sitting down and weeding the onions. And I was listening to a module called Start the Right Business. And as I listened to it, all of a sudden, I got this jolt like lightning of realization that I'd always wanted to have a big impact in the world. And I had given that dream up. I had given it up for the reasons that I mentioned, but also probably other ones that I was not aware of, including the thought came into my head, who are you, Linda, to want to have a big impact? Isn't that just grandiose? And I had this feeling, but grandiose or not, this is what I want to do. And if I get to the end of my life and I haven't figured out what that even is, I know I'm going to regret it. It took me a couple of years to ease out of the farm business and build something new. But I went into the online space with vigor and a sense of being intrepid to find out what it is that I could offer that would make a difference in the world. And the first thing I came upon was that I had gotten to a place of letting go of struggling with things and resisting things. And I thought, well, maybe I can help people with that. And my first business was built around, I think I called it High on Life, Strategies for Everyday Bliss. And so one thing that people who start an online business will recognize that once you have your website up and you have your idea, well, you got to let people know that you're there, because if people don't know that you exist, you can't get clients. So I thought, well, I think video is the way to go. And I started to take video classes. I remember it was like 100 days of video, and I did that. And afterwards I said, I think I'll do that again. And so I did it again. I did another 100 days of video. Everything was like posted on YouTube, unlisted. No one saw it except for a couple of people in the class. And then my teacher said, you know, there's this new app called Periscope, and it's going to change the online space forever. It uses something called live streaming. It was the first live streaming app. Actually, there is another one called Meerkat that nobody has heard of. Have you guys heard of Periscope, though?
No, I've never heard of it.
No. Oh, my God. So it was 2015. They had 9 months to themselves before Facebook figured out the technology. All the marketing gurus said, this is amazing, but you got to get on every day to build your following. And I thought, okay, I've always been late. I'm old. I mean, I'm older. I'm in my 60s. I was in my late 50s at the time. I always felt like I was late to the party. I thought, I'm going to hop on this. I want to be an early adopter. So I hopped on. And my God, it was terrifying, because you would say broadcast and suddenly people would be streaming on from India and France and Germany and Hawaii and California. And it was like overwhelming. And I felt like my whole kind of brain lifted up out of my body, and I would like work to bring myself back down into my feet so I could speak coherently. And after the first week, I reached out to this video mentor. I said, I'm really scared. Are you scared? Is it just me? And she said, oh, you'll be fine, Linda. After about 10 weeks, you'll just feel comfortable. And I was thinking, I did the math, 10 weeks, 70 days or so. So I figured out that I'll be able to do this if I have enough tools. And I Googled how to get over my fear of speaking. And I did affirmations and meditation and deep breathing and power poses. And I held crystals and you name it, I tried it. And I was just certain that I'm going to do this. I'm going to prepare myself in these ways every day, and I'll be fine in a few weeks. Well, I got to the 10th week. It was probably, I think it was day 75. I went to press broadcast. And before I pressed it, I noticed that my heart was still pounding hard. And I thought, what's the matter with me? This is 10 weeks. Why isn't this gone already? I just want it to be gone. And that's when I realized something that totally changed the course of my career, which is that you can't put a Band-Aid on fear. At least for me, I knew if I was going to get rid of the fear, I was going to have to get to the root of it, that I couldn't just mask it with managing skills. I wanted to dissolve it so I didn't have anything that I had to manage. And the first thing I asked myself is, okay, if I'm going to get rid of this thing, what is this thing? What is it trying to tell me? And the first thing that came to my mind was, I'm going to be attacked. And at first I thought, okay, is this like cellular human history memory of being chased on the Serengeti by, you know, a saber-toothed tiger? And then I thought, well, actually, I remember being attacked as a kid. My sisters used to attack me every time my mom put me in the center of attention and said to my sisters, why can't you girls be more like Linda? Because I was the goody-goody in the family and they were naughty. And she favored me and let them know, to my detriment, because as soon as she said that, they would charge, kick me in the shins and say, shut up, stupid. And then it hit me. I didn't feel comfortable on camera. I didn't feel comfortable speaking in public. I would never introduce this. I mean, I tried never to introduce a song in my music group. I didn't feel comfortable because I remembered, there's a part of me that remembered the times it was dangerous to be the center of attention. And then I went, holy moly, how come people aren't talking about this? I mean, once I knew I had stuff to clear, I knew I could clear it away because I had all these tools I had gathered from all my work in personal development and in grad school. And it was just something that I was deeply interested in. So I said, okay, what are my list of tools here? I did something called EFT, which is emotional freedom technique. Maybe you've heard of that. did journaling, I did forgiveness, I danced for release, I did creative visualization. I thought of all the comments that had been made to me that I could remember. And I forgave everybody that I could think of. Just even like things in passing, nothing was too small. I wasn't going to leave like anything, any stone unturned. And something must have moved the needle, because after 5 days, I had no more racing heart. And the following week, I got onto my Periscope broadcast after a really, really busy day. I was running around and I said to them, I heard myself say, I'm so grateful to be able to get to live stream, because after a hectic day, I can just turn on the camera and relax. I thought, whoa, relax on camera? I would never have expected that. And then the next time I performed with my group, when it was my turn to introduce a song, I used to kind of mess up all the songs ahead of mine, the one that I had to introduce. That didn't happen. And when it was my turn, in my head, I heard, oh, good, it's my turn to speak. And I thought, this is nice. This is really nice. I just felt like this sense of freedom, a sense of ease. I didn't have to spend all this time managing my energy, my feelings, this thing that felt so out of my control. But I didn't start right away thinking, oh, this is what I want to help people with. People started to say, Linda, would you help me with this? Because I shared what had happened to me. And I said, okay, let's see. I don't know. Was my story. I have my story. You have your story. My tools that I like using, I don't know if they'll work with you, but they did. And so over the course of the year, I had more people who asked me to help them. Then I had someone who wasn't just wanting to get on camera, because I wasn't a speaker at that time, but someone who was came to me and she said, will help me with public speaking. And I said, I don't know, but we can try. And I really resisted doing this as my coaching work as its own thing, because it felt too narrow. I thought, I don't want to just do this. I want to help people in lots of different ways. But then I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll just start with a course first. And I started with a course called Comfy on Camera, which I still teach many iterations later. And as I was promoting it, I started to write blog posts. And I thought, oh, this is kind of an interesting topic. And the more I got into it, I realized it had so much depth and so much breadth that I could easily swim around and be creative in this space for a long time. And that's when I decided, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to help people overcome their fear of speaking so they can delight in the limelight.
I listened to your book. Thank you for doing audio version. As our audience knows, I'm not a huge reader, although I love learning things. So I'm a big fan of audiobooks. The way you broke it down, part one was the reveal and heal, which is what you were just talking about. I appreciate the fact that I think there was 5 ways of healing past memories. So it wasn't just a single facet of trying to get in, like, this is the way you have to heal. It's like, we're all individuals. So the fact that you're able to do all those different avenues to provide healing. Then in your second section, it was restoring safety, really great stuff. And the third section was about repatterning your habits. The sense of the book that I got, which is what you just addressed, that it's not limited to public speaking. It really was just about trying to reconnect with yourself and promote self-growth. And then with that, then it's like, oh, well, now I'm okay public speaking, because I have all these tools that have boosted my confidence and boosted my self-growth. When you were just talking about that, I felt that in the book, that it's such a wide range of health and support that your book can encourage and help people beyond just public speaking. So I just wanted to bring that part up.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up, Colin, because it does not escape me that the work that I do is broader. What I love about working with speakers or performers is that I feel that they are motivated to clean up their stuff, because they really want to get to a place where they feel like they can just express themselves wherever they are, whether it's on camera or on stage or in a meeting or media or a sales call or around the family table.
I'm with Colin. I like that aspect of what it is that you do. Like you said, not putting a Band-Aid on problems so that I can achieve this outcome that I have in my mind. Like, I've set this goal, there's this task, there's this performance, and I want to do it well. And so all my focus is going to go on the performance. Instead, you're looking to the left of the performance. What conditions need to be present in order for that performance to emerge normally, naturally, from just the conditions that already are there? My work that I do in the performance psychology world, that's a concept that is a struggle, and it shouldn't be, to get across to some of the clients I have. They are so focused on the end state. They are so focused on the goal that's been identified either by themselves or by others that they miss that what's important is setting those conditions to the left, that confidence, the understanding of why it is that they're doing what they're doing, the value of engaging in the activity. These are all things that really matter. The motivation, where it's coming from, these are things that are critical. And if they exist, if those conditions are present, then the performance, it does, it manifests. We are capable of being at our best in those moments with little struggle. It doesn't mean that there aren't some techniques, like you point out, the breathing or different focus and attention control things or mental imagery to be able to practice some of these things. Those are absolutely helpful. But really focusing on those conditions to the left, I think is critical. And it seems like that's where a lot of your focus goes.
I wouldn't put any blame on people because we have been programmed to look for the end state. I mean, that's what education is all about. We're looking to make the grade. So all those days in school, working to get a grade, trying to please the teacher, everything in our society tells us it's about the externalities. So what we're trying to do, you know, the three of us, and I know there are many, many more people out there, trying to let people know, at least once they come out of school, you know what? You're out of school, but we got to get the school out of your brain because there's something more important here, which is what you're saying, Brian, that it's not just the end game. It's not the end goal because the goal, as we know, always moves. We always are moving the goal further and further away. So if we only derive our sense of satisfaction and pride from reaching a goal, that only lasts a little while before we have a new one. So we spend most of the time feeling like we're not enough. Whereas when you do bring that sense of presence and experience, then you can enjoy the process as you go along through each moment in time. So you can enjoy that process of becoming and not just of achieving.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. There are a couple different directions that I'd love to go, but let's stick with the school one for a minute. Let me just ask you, what are the ages that you tend to work with? It sounds like you typically work with adults. Have you thought about transitioning what you do into the younger ages, into elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, et cetera? Or have you already done that?
I rather work with adults. I like diving into the deeper, darker stuff with them. It feels creative to me. I like working with the emotional intelligence that adults have. I, however, would love to train people to do it in the school system because I feel that the more it happens at a younger age, that kids are made to feel great about who they are and expressing themselves, and they're given space, and they're given spaces that allow them to not feel like they're in a sense a place of trauma all the time. Because when you're in school, you are doing a performance all the time. It's always high stakes. The teacher calls on you, and the question is, do I know the answer or do I not? And oh my God, what's going to happen if I don't know it? Are the kids going to laugh at me? They're going to snicker? I mean, we're so concerned with what others think of us. And also, what grade are we going to have? And then how are our parents going to feel? So there are all these layers of concern that kids are enduring day in and day out for hours of the day. And so it's no wonder why we have a whole society where they say one of the biggest fears is public speaking. I think one of the biggest fears is doing stunts.
You just got to turn off a little bit of your self-preservation, you know, like, hey, you want me to fall down those stairs? All right, that seems fine. We'll just let gravity take over.
I hope we come back to that turning off the self-preservation, because I think that is, there's something there that is relevant to public speaking as well.
You approach this topic in the book about self-preservation. It's like when you turn that off a little bit and then you realize, oh, I'm going to be fine. That is such a great empowerment to feel, because it's like, yes, I'm falling downstairs. I could get hurt. But then you fall downstairs and you're like, oh, I'm actually okay. And that's kind of the same thing if we tie that back into public speaking. I'm going to go out on stage and I'm going to fail. And therefore, I don't want to do it. And there's a fear to that. But you turn off that self-preservation, you go out on stage and maybe you fail. Then afterwards, you're like, I'm still okay. And I think that that is an important thing to recognize. One of the quotes from your book that really resounded with me was, fear is not the villain, it's the messenger. And through all of your techniques, that's recognizing what that fear is. And it's not the fear itself. It's like, as you said, when you started doing the Periscope thing, why is my heart racing? Like, what is this fear about? Then you were able to find out what it was about. Fear was the messenger. You were able to conquer the problem, and then you didn't have that fear anymore. I just really like that quote.
Yeah, let's unpack that a little bit. So when somebody says, I'm worried about being judged, or I'm worried about what someone's going to think about me, or what people are going to think about me, I might ask them, if I'm working with them, well, where have you felt judged in the past? Or are you afraid everyone's going to judge you? Or is there one person or a few people in particular that you're worried about? Because what happens then is that you can follow these threads back to understand what is the original, or what may be some of the original causes of experiences. Now, everybody has positive and negative experiences in their lives. There are two things that emerge from it. One is, what are the conclusions we make about those? What are the stories we begin to tell ourselves because of those things? Or have we been able to come out of them with a sense of wholeness where we don't feel like we've been torn apart and injured? And so, like, a lot of times people will have, like, maybe they were belittled by their parent or by someone at school, and they try to prove themselves. They try to get this person to like them or to love them or pay any kind of attention to them, but could never get it. And so there's this wound that stays with them that says to them, I must not be worthy. People must not be interested in what I have to say. Or if, in my case, my sister's being jealous of me, I don't want to be the center of attention because I may have people who are jealous of me and will attack me. Or I may lose their love. I felt like my sisters hated me because I was the goody-goody and my mom loved me more, so they hated me. Just got to say that I grew up in a really close relationship with my sisters, and still I recognize this to be true, that there was still a part of me that thought, oh my God, if I do well, if I succeed, if I get a lot of attention, they're not going to love me. So we can grow up, and it's kind of like a tree that grows around a rock or something. But there's always that wound that is there until we resolve it in some way. And so, like, even what you were saying before about having evidence that, oh no, I didn't die, I fell down the stairs and I'm okay. To get to that place of feeling that you're okay, you need to clear enough of this other deeper stuff away. Because the deeper stuff is a trigger that is, like, beyond your mental awareness. It's subconscious. But once that's cleared away, then you can go and say, I survived. I didn't die. Yeah, I had my heart was beating a little fast, but all in all, it's okay. And then you can start to build on that. You can start to say, okay, well, I was nervous at the beginning, but I calmed down after 5 or 10 minutes. So then you look at, what does that sense of calmness feel like? And how can I draw back to the beginning so I can start with that? How can I draw it back so while I'm preparing, I also have that sense of knowing that it's going to be fine? So we can take the knowledge of our experience, the evidence of our experience, and start to expand it. And I think, you know, we get so many messages of just do it and you'll see it's okay. And that does work for the people who don't have a lot of triggering experiences, you know, and that's why it's worth it. It's worth it to try something because you never know until you try it. What I realize is that it's almost like salt. So, like, when you're cooking and you put in too much salt in a dish, you ruin it. That's like the adrenaline, cortisol, or whatever those hormones are. But just a little bit makes it tasty, and a little bit of adrenaline or cortisol, and I would have to look it up which it is, actually sharpens your acuity. So it's all about the dosage.
That's something that's really important, I think, with all performers, is that there's a right amount of energy activation, of that physiological energy activation. You don't want to go in drained and down and with no activation, you know, so you mentioned your heart pounding and stuff when you were talking earlier. Well, the heart pounding is not necessarily a bad thing. Now, if it's pounding too much, that's a problem and we might need to regulate it a little bit, but some pounding's a good thing. And I don't know, Colin, if you think the same way, but I'll tell you, when I'm doing stunts and I'm on set and something's getting ready to happen, we're getting ready to do a gag. If I'm not feeling some heart pounding, if I'm not feeling some of that physiological activation, that's a red flag to me that something's wrong, that I'm not in the place where I need to be. And it happens sometimes. Sometimes people think that that's weird. Like, wait a minute, you're getting ready to go do this thing and get thrown around all whatever. But after 14 hours of sitting on set, you know, and now it's time to do this. Yeah, sometimes you have to actually pump up rather than calm down. But there is that right amount of energy activation. Colin, have you experienced that adjustment?
Yeah, I think I have two examples. There was a time where a young stuntman and I were going through this window. And we're going to go through the window and then hit the ground and then little scuffle. And he was pretty new to the business. He's like hitting himself, psyching himself up. And I don't mean to be like, I'm the old guy, like, hey, we'll just do it. But it was just like, this is kind of what he needed to get himself into a spot to be able to do this. Now, was he over psyching? Was he overdoing it? I don't think so. I think he was just putting himself in the right mindset for it. Where I know, like, sometimes if I get too wound up, then it's a red flag of it's too much because the adrenaline's going to hit you once you go through the window. So it's like, I don't want to overamp it and then just be drained and unfocused. But the other side of it, I was on trampoline and I was going to do a double twisting, double flip. And I was about to do it. I'm like, I should put some effort into this. I'm like, nah, I do this all the time. It's not that big of a deal. And my energy or my focus was low because I undersold it to myself. And I screwed it up and I crashed. And I remember wrenching my neck. That was a lesson to me. Like, even if it's something you do all the time, you need to pump it up enough to be focused enough because what we're doing is dangerous. What you're saying, Brian, I've experienced both sides of it. You overamp, that is also dangerous, but underamped is equally as dangerous because you need to put the right amount of salt in the dish to keep you focused and safe.
Yeah, and sometimes even from a public speaking standpoint, you might be doing 5 presentations in a day. And for the first one, maybe there's a bunch of energy activation. You need to calm down a little bit. And maybe, you know, after time 4 and time 5 is coming up, now you're tired and you've done it several times. And so now you need to actually pump up. So the task hasn't changed. It's still you standing up and giving an engaging presentation. And this is important, the amount of energy activation that you need in order to do that presentation well also hasn't changed. It's just the energy activation level that you're naturally experiencing prior to that may have changed. So you might need to boost it up. You might need to calm it down. But this step one comes to awareness. It's an awareness of what is my right amount of energy activation. And Linda, throughout your book and the different discussions you've had, a couple things have really stuck out to me. And one of them is this importance of self-awareness, this tuning into what's going on mentally, what's going on emotionally, what is happening with me? And that leads me to a question. Where did that emphasis come from? You've said a few things that lead me to believe that you've done some studying in Eastern philosophy. Where did this focus on acceptance, for example? You've talked about acceptance and awareness and trust in yourself and letting go of trying to control things. All of these things are very Eastern in their nature. Is that something you've ever spent any time thinking about, reading about?
I have. And in fact, when I was in my 20s, I traveled 6 months in Asia by myself.
It's so crazy. You mentioned that in the book. And I was like, what? I wouldn't do that now. It's amazing. Amazing.
You know, it's funny. So many people say, oh, that's so brave. And it didn't feel brave. It was, I mean, there's a story behind of how it happened, but I just did it. However, really where I feel that most of my way that I like to deconstruct experiences for other people to learn them is through the dance therapy world. So when I was 19, I took my first dance therapy course. I didn't really know what I was getting into. There was a guy who I liked and he came up to Boston and I thought, oh, I want to come to Boston and be nearby. And there was this dance program at Tufts University that turned out to be dance therapy. And what I loved about it, and I loved dance, but I was learning mostly choreography. I had done a little bit of improvisation, but what we did was we would explore these elements, like moving closer to someone and moving further away and getting close and further away, or up and down, or curved lines versus straight lines, or different kinds of qualities like sudden or legato. And after we would explore it in movement, we would journal about it. And then we'd debrief. We talk about it. So it got me into this rhythm and appreciation of deconstructing very small elements. Nothing is too small to practice. And paying attention to what the inner experience is, and then being able to articulate that with other people so we can broaden our inner world through the sharing of it in a creative way. That was the origins of my work. Now, I've done other things since then that have built upon that, but I think those two, the travel to Asia and also this dance therapy model.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that was also a theme as I was looking through your book, and then even as you've been talking throughout, was that a lot of the problems that you mentioned seemed to stem from one place, like one main place, and that is comparing oneself to others. In other words, judging one's competence based on how I compare to others. What are they going to think about me? How are they going to react to me? If I do this, what are they going to feel? What's going to be the result? How did you shift that perspective to care more about and just be more cognizant of and place more emphasis on you rather than what others are thinking?
I think actually that I was really helped with being in the online space. So as an entrepreneur, one of the wise suggestions that I would hear around me is about staying in your own lane. And I always had this, I guess, from other areas of my life, the idea that there are many paths to the spirit. You know, there are many ways of doing things. But this idea of staying in your own lane, that I have my own personal journey in my life that starts from when I was born and continues through, just as you do, Brian, and you do, Colin, and every other single person on the planet. This is our chance of our own experience on Earth during our lifetime. Then we can surrender to that and not feel as knocked around by outside forces. Now, this is not to say that we don't look for others to inspiration, that we aren't without feelings of jealousy or envy, but that we can utilize them to recognize that when we see something that we feel envious of, and this was huge help for me, given my background that I shared, that I quit teaching dance because of my feelings of jealousy. When I came into the online space, I found somebody who made this suggestion, and it's been life-changing for me, to look at what someone does that I feel jealous of. Okay, I'm having this reaction. What is it about this person or what they're doing or what they have that I want for myself? And do I want that for myself? So again, it's kind of like looking at it as a messenger rather than a villain. And when I began to do that, I could see, oh, I really love how much engagement that person has. And it makes me think, well, yes, I would like that kind of engagement too. Okay, what would I need to do in order to create that kind of engagement? Maybe I need to learn how to write copy in a way that's more engaging, or ask questions, or maybe I need to be telling stories. Maybe I can explore those kinds of things. Then suddenly it opens up into my own experience and what I can do for myself to create more growth on a personal level. And then I can say thank you to that person for showing me this is something that I want for myself. I may have also decided, well, actually, I don't want everything that they have because I like what I have. So even though there's this one element that they like that I'm a little envious of, I'll leave the rest. Thank you very much. How do you deal with professional jealousy or envy? What's worked for you?
Well, you know, one of the things that we talked about in our those couple podcasts ago that we did with another stunt guy, fear came up, and we discussed fear and really talked about it in basically the same way that you just mentioned. Is it's not a bad thing. It's not a villain. It's a tool that we can use. We can leverage especially the physiological components of fear to allow us to be better in those moments. But also, like you said, it's a teaching tool. What am I afraid of? That's really what you got to ask the question of. What are you afraid of? Is it injury that you're afraid of? Is it failure? And if it is failure, why does that matter? Is it a career thing? Is it a money financial thing that you're worried about getting hired again? Is it that you think you're going to lose friends or lose respect? What is it that is driving this fear? And we've spent a lot of time talking about that. And I think that the ways that you're describing that really makes sense. And I think that taking it out of the realm of fear into the other emotions that we may feel relative to somebody else is a great way of thinking about it. What can I learn from this situation? Whatever that situation might be, maybe the situation is the experience of envy. Okay, well, I'm experiencing envy. What can I learn from this experience? If I'm experiencing anxiety, what can I learn from this? And I think that, you know, when you mentioned the threat, so I'm feeling fear, that means that I'm perceiving a threat. There's been some research, and I forget the exact name of the theory that it comes from, but where emotions are predicted by the types of perceptions that we have. So when we perceive a threat, some sort of harm to ourselves, fear is a natural, normal thing. Fear, anxiety, just like if we feel like we lost something that we value or care about, then sadness is a normal, natural emotion. That's what we can expect. Or if we feel like somebody's done something wrong to us, we've been harmed in some way by somebody or something, then anger is the emotion we can experience. So understanding and tuning into these experiences that we have and then asking the question, where is this coming from? Why am I feeling like this person did something wrong to me? Why am I feeling threatened? What is it exactly that I think I've lost? I think those are great questions, and I appreciate you connecting that.
I think for me, back to when you're asking about envy, you had mentioned this in the book about the imposter syndrome, feeling like I shouldn't be at this party, but I'm here. I have a little bit of that in a professional sense. But one thing that helps me deal with that is the history of how I got here. A lot of the imposter syndrome for me actually almost comes from envy, because I'm like, that person is awesome and what they're doing is great. I can't do that. I shouldn't be here. Like I said, the way I help deal with this is just, but I am here. So the history of how I got here really helps me deal with that emotion. The show Limitless with Chris Hemsworth on Disney Plus right now. And at one point, him and a friend are doing a little Aboriginal walkabout, and they met with some leaders. And the message there was, hear the world with your own ears and see the world with your own eyes. And that statement is so powerful to me to help me realize I am valid. There's a reason why I'm here. And that envy that I might have, as you say, I could recognize what they're doing and maybe incorporate. I'm like, okay, that part's great. I would like to do more of that and then pursue it in a positive way. One of the things that I love about these discussions is how they're all tied together. Like the envy from the fear to self-confidence to seeing and hearing the world and with your own eyes. It's like all this recognition and growth. It all helps. It all helps. And there's so many different ways to have that self-awareness, to have that present moment awareness.
I love that cultural value. Hear with your own ears, see with your own eyes. I mean, it kind of is a teaching that, as you said, we all matter and our perspective matters, which is quite different than don't speak unless spoken to. Children should be seen and not heard. If you have nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. All these other cultural values that we grew up with, or don't stand out, keep your head down, don't brag, you know, all these things that kind of work against us to be fully ourselves.
That's an interesting thing to bring up. I appreciate you bringing up those beliefs, because there are some that are so common in our culture, and they're not common in all cultures. Each culture has its own set of values, beliefs, mores, you know, these unspoken ways of doing things that exist. But there are some that are very common in our society, and some are explicit. You hear them a lot. People should pull themselves up by their bootstraps, or, you know, I don't know, something that's very common. But
who says that? People don't say that nowadays, by the way.
People don't say that?
No.
All right.
Oh, they'll say, pull yourself together.
Okay,
there you go. Pull yourself together. Yeah. Colin's going to modernize me. Pull me out of the 1800s. That's good. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
but there are these beliefs, and they're so powerful. This is one of the things that I really emphasize with clients and people I work with. We all have values and beliefs. And they come from somewhere. Some of them are cultural. Some of them are just, they're just embedded in each of the interactions we have throughout society. But others are more situation specific, maybe from our families, because my family might have different values or beliefs than other families. And some truly are just developed from us and our unique experiences that we have. Do you in your work with people parse those beliefs and values in that way? Do you separate out what might be a societal norm that's holding somebody back versus a personally developed based on their own unique experience value? Is that something you discuss?
I don't know if I highlight it as such, but yes, we get into all those because, for instance, I'm working with someone who's both a private client and in the Comfy on Camera class. And now that she is looking back on her videos, she says, you know what? I look at myself and I feel kind of asleep, to your point about matching energy you were talking about before. And she said, as I think about it, I'm thinking about where I grew up, which was in Eastern Europe. And to be good was someone who was quiet, followed all the rules, who didn't stand out, who didn't make waves, who didn't disrupt the energy that you didn't really notice. And she said, I think that's what I'm doing. She said, but now that I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, I want to speak louder. I want to have more energy. I want to use, you know, see the energy in me. I don't want to look like I'm asleep. And so I prefer it when someone, like in this case, comes to their own conclusion, because I feel like it's more powerful when we discover things for ourselves. But I am not beyond pointing out to things as I hear them. And I also inquire. I'll say, is this something that you might have grown up with? Or what were the messages you got about your voice and how much space you take up and, you know, these things? Because that's all telling. And sometimes, as you said, it can come from the culture. My sister lives in Denmark, and I know there, they are discouraged from standing out from the crowd. And I've heard the same thing in Australia. They have this idea of the tall poppy. You hit the tall poppy down so it doesn't stand out from the rest. And then, you know, in Asia, they have their own, you know, culture. So when we work with people from different countries, we have to be alert to the possibilities that they're going to have their own cultural values that they grew up with that are going to be impacting them, whether they've come to the US or they are in a global sphere and they're seeing their need to interact with players from different countries, they want to up their game and they need to be able to say, yeah, that was my culture. That's what I have been doing as a default, but I can choose to expand the way I express myself now because I have agency as an adult.
Yeah, that poppy story is very interesting to me because what came to mind as you said it is, okay, so the value is everybody's equal. Nobody should stand out. So we're going to knock down the people who stand up. But in my mind, I'm thinking, well, it could work the other way too. If it's possible for one to get higher, why don't we raise the others up to that level?
Well, I totally agree.
It's a good point.
So just different way of looking at it. Yeah, let's raise the others up instead of knocking the ones down. How about we do that?
Yeah. I love what you're saying about this, because this brings me to, or makes me think of, we are looking at how do we adjust to the society we live in? How about instead we create the society we want to live in?
Yes, that's a great statement. And I think that's one thing that we're trying to do with this podcast is we're trying to look at these cultural mores and saying, why? Why are we still doing it like this? Let's raise everything up, as Brian just said, instead of knocking them down. I have a question just about public speaking and back to your book. So with all these different nuances that we were talking about, what do you feel is the most important? I don't know if you can just put it into one statement, but like, what is the most important way someone can go from being terrified from public speaking to being comfortable with it?
You described the inner freedom framework at the beginning, the reveal and heal, restore safety, and then repattern your habits. And that's the playground that I work in. We got to look at what may be getting triggered and not just what is it, but then what do you do with it? Because it's one thing to know what it is. It's another thing to be able to clear it away. And the way we clear it away is that when we have a memory that is stuck and it's a trigger, it's like a grenade, it has a neural pathway that gets grooved in over and over and over. And what we do, I believe, in healing is that we're bringing more life into that memory. So we're widening the perspective. We're bringing new thoughts and feelings and experiences to that, whether it's imagining how it could have worked out or talking to your younger self and giving it love and appreciation and encouragement, or telling that younger self what you wish someone could have said to you at the time. All of a sudden, you feel that part of you has a sense of satiation and resolution, and then it can rest. It can be like packed up and put away in the closet without causing trouble anymore. So I think that's a real key, and that's a key for the work that I do. But it's also, along with that, the restoring safety, because we can be in a safe environment. We can know that no one is out to get us here, but we can still feel afraid. And why is that? It's because of the fear that we're creating in our own minds by the demands that we place upon ourselves, by the self-criticism that we have. And there's studies that I mention in the book between University of Massachusetts and McGill that show that people who criticize themselves are less likely to achieve their goals. So it's super important for us to be able to transform that part of ourselves that has, and I believe again, that we're not naturally self-critical. I think we have a sense of judgment and evaluation, but it doesn't have to be hurtful or harmful. I think that is a wounded part of ourselves. And that when we also find a way to resolve that so we don't feel like we need to harm ourselves, that we can really truly be as encouraging, compassionate, loving, supportive, like really try to make ourselves feel as good as we can with every mistake we made, in every way that we may not live up to our own expectations, to be our biggest supporter, that we are able to enter into, move through our life with more grace, more poise, more energy and possibility and freedom to take risks, because we know we've got our own backs.
Yeah, the self-talk, I think, is really important. And I think you bring up a good point with the criticism. So to just explore that and parse it a little bit, I think that it is not a bad thing, as you said, to evaluate oneself. And some people think about that in terms of criticism. So I'm going to criticize my performance, meaning I'm going to evaluate it. I'm going to break it down. I'm going to see what worked, what didn't work. And if it didn't work, I'm going to assess why so that I can maybe do it better next time. That's a great thing to do. I think where that evaluation, criticism, however, whatever term you want to use, becomes a problematic is when the criticism or evaluation turns to the person themselves. In other words, I am bad. I am insufficient. I am not capable of doing this. It's me. It's a personality flaw. It is something wired into me that I cannot fix. I am at my core a bad person or incapable for some reason. And it's really the difference between shame and guilt. Brené Brown does a great job of distinguishing between those two things. Shame being, I am bad. Guilt being, I did something bad. Guilt is something that can be beneficial because you're focused on behaviors that can change, that are things outside ourselves that we can take control of. Whereas the shame, that comes from a place of just, there is a lack of control because we believe that that's just how we are. Just to clarify, that criticism, that evaluation, that judgment that you just mentioned, I think it can be very helpful if we're targeting those things we can adjust in productive ways. However, it can be incredibly harmful for us in many, many ways if we're focusing on, like you mentioned before, the stories we tell ourselves about why things happen. The reason for this thing is me. It's some flaw that is just ingrained within me.
So then with that perspective, it's important, as we kind of started talking about this, about self-awareness and the things that we can change about the perspective on the guilt as a learning tool, and as failure as a learning tool, as opposed to placing the shame upon yourself. Like you just said, it's so important to keep that self-awareness about not blaming yourself, but being able to recognize things that you can change. And so I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah. And you know what, Linda, our time is just about up. And so I wanted to ask you before we end up wrapping this thing up, is there anything that we've missed? Is there anything that you want to make sure you get out there. Anything that you want to say?
What's coming to me right now is this balance of how we evaluate ourselves. I don't know if you've heard of Howard Glasser. He became well known for his work with the difficult child. And what he discovered with difficult children, which applies to all children and all of us, I would say, and I think he would too, is that we tend to give a lot of eloquent and emotional energy when things aren't right. And we tend to be very kind of blasé and boring when things are going well. And if we can switch that around and be very matter of fact, very neutral about the things that aren't working or that need to improve, but give a lot of energy and a lot of appreciation and open-heartedness to the things that we like and we appreciate and we're proud about, I think it's going to make a huge difference for how people feel about their own personal possibilities.
It's well spoken.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Before we go, where can we find you? Do you have a website? We've already talked about your book. Where else are you that people can find you if they want to know more?
LindaUgolo.com is my website. You can get my book, Delight in the Limelight, wherever books are sold. I have various different programs that I run. Of course, I coach, but right now coming up or periodically, I run Comfy on Camera, which is a wonderful way to explore what it means to be comfortable, what it means to relax in yourself, what it means to be in a safe environment in your own head and in a community, and what the possibilities are for you expanding into your free expression when you have that kind of place to practice.
That's great. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a fascinating discussion and just really appreciate it. I love the book. Has so many great techniques, as I said before, about not just helping out in public speaking, but just helping personal growth. Thank you so much for being on our program. It's been fantastic.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time, Linda. It was a pleasure when I was able to be on your podcast, and I love talking to you again here. Thank you so much.
Yes. Well, to be continued.
I love it. I love it. Yes. More to come.
And that concludes our episode. We want to thank Linda Ugolo again. Thank you so much for being here. It was such a great conversation. And if you want to hear more of our podcast, you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and at our website, pokingholesandblinders.org. Brian?
Yeah, and Amazon Music, too. Don't forget Amazon Music. You can find us on there as well. And if sports psychology, performance psychology is something that might be helpful for you, your kids, anybody else you know, you can find information about what it is that I do with that at beginagainperformancepsychology.com. We enhance confidence. We boost motivation. We give people tools to be their best in whatever performance environment they happen to find themselves. And if you're looking for a book to read, I wrote one, and you can find that on Amazon. It's called Begin Again, Utilize the Wisdom of Eastern and Western Ideologies to Achieve Your Full Potential. It'll keep you busy for at least a year. That's what I got, man.
Beautiful. Thanks again for listening to Poking Holes in Blinders, where knowledge infused with compassion fuels better decisions. Later.